we really are looking for businesses that allow you to have your low carbon cake and eat it. Because the only way that you drive change in an industry like the construction sector is by providing a solution which is economically attractive. The political cycle is a real challenge when you're dealing with things that have 10, 20, 30, hundreds of years of potential impact. What we do is not wait for the politicians. At the end of the day, we're focusing on the entrepreneurs that are out there developing technologies that can make a difference right now and which are economically viable in the market today.
From the first-time founders to the funds that back them, innovation needs different. Our episode partner, HSBC Innovation Banking, is proud to accelerate growth for tech and life science businesses, creating meaningful connections and opening up a world of opportunity for entrepreneurs and investors alike. Discover more at www.hsbcinnovationbanking.com/en-gb. Hello and welcome to the UKTM podcast, a weekly chat with the movers and shakers of the UK tech industry and the destination for all things UK tech related. And today I am joined by Chris Morris, co-founder and chief operating officer at Sustainable Ventures, which invests in more than 700 climate tech startups around the UK. Welcome, Chris.
Very nice to be here, Jane. Thank you.
As you can probably hear, my voice is a little hoarse, so I do apologise again. I am still suffering with a little bit of a croaky voice, but we shall attempt to keep going and I'm sure everything will be fine. Let's start with you giving me a little bit of a flavour of the kind of some of the companies that are on your books. Climate tech covers a wide variety of companies, doesn't it? Give us a flavour of the sorts of things you have on there and the ones that you're particularly excited by. Obviously, I'm not asking you to choose favourites here, but just some of the ones that you think are really going to make a huge difference.
Sure. Well, as you say, Jane, climate tech is a very broad church. We operate across five principal verticals. Those are food and agritech, mobility, building technology, future energy, and the circular economy. And I won't be goaded into picking favourite children. That tends to get one in trouble. But happy to give a couple of examples of businesses that we are particularly proud to have worked with. Those include Beam, formerly Rovco, which is a leading deep technology company using AI and autonomy on robotic ships and underwater robots in the offshore renewable sector. And they are one of the fastest growing tech companies of any kind in the UK at the moment. And I have high hopes that they will be our first portfolio unicorn in the not too distant future as well. And Concrete for Change is a business I'm particularly excited about at the moment, operating in one of the sectors where carbon emissions are, I think, hardest to abate. And they have a technology which mineralizes CO2 into concrete. So helping concrete manufacturers and the construction industry more generally reach net zero.
That's interesting because building and construction is seen as one of the really big problems when it comes to carbon emissions. So is this going to be a game changer? And taking that as an example, it strikes me that a lot of these companies have got to make inroads and persuade whole industries to change the way that they do things. So how does a company that has a novel way of making concrete persuade an industry like the construction industry that has been, some would say, stuck in a certain way of doing things for many years to maybe change that?
I think it's true of almost every business that we support, actually, that their USP rooted in sustainability or resource efficiency needs to provide a commercial advantage. So we really are looking for businesses that allow you to have your low carbon cake and eat it. Because the only way that you drive change in an industry like the construction sector is by providing a solution which is economically attractive as well as environmentally so. Whilst consumer appetite is changing, at the end of the day, people aren't prepared to pay a significant green premium when it comes to things like sustainable property. So it needs to stack up economically as well. And that is critical for Concrete for Change, proving that they can reach parity with the sector as a whole.
And not only do you, these companies have to persuade whole sectors of industry to change the way they're doing, there's got to be a lot of conversations with government as well. Government being very crucial to moving the climate crisis agenda forward in a positive way. How do you think Labour is doing so far?
Well, what are we now? We're 120 days, are we? Something like that, into the new government. You certainly can't fault their ambition, that's for sure. And it was always going to be interesting to see how bold claims for net zero in the power sector by 2030 were going to pass the test once the government was in power. And thus far, I've been fairly pleasantly surprised that their ambitions don't seem to have been tempered by reality as of yet. And I'm cautiously optimistic about the support this sector is going to get from this Labour government. However, they are going to need to work with the private sector in a collaborative manner like no Labour government before, if we're going to achieve the pace of change that we all agree, I think, is needed over the years ahead.
And what are some of those things that they'll need to do?
So don't break the things that are already working. I think that is always challenging when you have a changing of the guard like this with so many ideological differences. But there are certain things that we've become world leaders in over the last decades, and we need to make sure we don't lose that. Things such as supporting early stage technology development and attracting early stage investment into sectors like the climate and sustainability space. And I've seen lots of very positive signs regarding their support for big ticket, big capex projects, offshore renewables, for instance, and indeed onshore wind. And that's fantastic. But I think it's critical as well that they continue to support earlier stage innovation, things that perhaps won't move the needle that much for their 2030 targets, but are going to be absolutely essential for keeping us on that trajectory. So I think my one bit of advice to this Labour government at this stage would be, don't be too myopic in the focus on 2030 and the focus on clean power. Innovation in climate tech more generally is crucial and somewhere where we are leading globally at the moment, and that needs to stay the case.
They're probably more myopic than even 2030 because, you know, the problem with politics is that you've got a 4 or 5 year window to make change. And a lot of the things that you're talking about, especially if it's early startups, aren't going to have made any change in that timeframe. So how do you kind of reconcile those two things, the timelines of government versus the timelines of some of your startups?
Well, I don't think we can fix democracy on this podcast, probably. And the political cycle is a real challenge when you're dealing with things that have 10, 20, 30, hundreds of years of potential impact. I think it is encouraging the extent to which climate as a subject on the totem pole is pretty constant now. It isn't debated as much because I think we do have a fair degree of political agreement and quite a lot of public will to support some of the tough decisions that need to be made in the sector. So I think as a result, it would be so deeply unpopular to be focusing on the very, very near term and ignoring this transition to net zero across a variety of different sectors, that even with a 4 or 5 year cycle in mind, I think it is very much on the radar. So I am, for that reason, reasonably optimistic.
The other question that always occurs to me when it comes to governments and this agenda for carbon neutral and just basically making big changes to the climate problem is that there's a lot of talking. We've seen all the COP talks and we have all levels of government, global discussions about this. But does it move much beyond the talking? And what can we do to move that from just a conversation and a sort of soundbite at the end of a big global conference to real change?
Well, what we do is not wait for the politicians. At the end of the day, we're focusing on the entrepreneurs that are out there developing technologies that can make a difference right now and which are economically viable in the market today. So we're not interested in supporting things that have a lot of regulatory risk anyway, because for exactly the reasons that you've outlined, you can't invest on the basis of political certainty now, really, at any point in the past. So my strong advice is, don't wait for the government to tell you what to do. Don't wait for them to incentivize certain technologies. Focus on what can be brought to market now. And there's an awful lot of exciting solutions out there.
And what is it that you offer these startups? You know, what can you do to support them on their journey?
So we at Sustainable Ventures exist to make sure that the UK's best climate tech entrepreneurs succeed. Succeed both in mitigating the worst effects of climate change, but also in delivering on what is a monumental economic opportunity. Specifically, we support in three areas. We invest early at a pre-seed stage, and we're currently deploying our seventh fund. We provide dedicated climate tech workspaces around which we're building real ecosystems driving change, including our headquarters at County Hall, opposite Westminster, where we can wave our fists where necessary. And thirdly, we offer targeted venture support. And a lot of that is publicly funded and also funded by our corporate partners, allowing us to directly fill the skills gaps and support these early stage businesses in getting to the next stage.
And in getting to that next stage, you mentioned the word unicorn. And where are we in terms of unicorns in this specific area of clean tech, green tech? Do we have any in the UK, in Europe, or, you know, is this something that we need to think about as the next stage? Because I can't think of any, but I might be wrong.
I almost regret mentioning it, to be honest, because I think we can get a little bit overexcited by arbitrary financial milestones. And we're very much of the opinion that there aren't any silver bullets out there. We need to focus on a large quantity of solutions that in aggregate are going to have the impact that we're looking for. But I think most of the really big companies driving change in this sector have focused on large CapEx, big box technologies. So there are charging infrastructure players, there are renewable developers and the like that have crossed that magic threshold. But in terms of innovative technology providers, I think very few, if any, in the UK as it stands. But I think that is something that will definitely change over the next couple of years.
It also feels that there's a challenge in getting investment beyond the early stage. There's organisations like you that are looking to do that sort of first stage. Here's a great idea and we'll invest in you pre-seed. But how do you keep that going so that these companies can really scale up?
Over the years, the funding gap, I think, has existed at various different stages. And it has moved a little bit further up the pitch now. And there is quite a lot of early stage capital flowing into the sector. And I think part of that is down to the tax breaks that we've had in this country. And they've been hugely supportive. We'll see what happens there tomorrow. But there is also a fair amount of later stage venture capital flowing into the space as well. So people investing at Series A, Series B, where I think almost everybody accepts that there is a gap at the moment is when it comes to first of a kind development funding. So investment that really should be debt, deploying relatively proven technology, but technology that perhaps hasn't been deployed at the scale that's being looked at before, and therefore traditional lenders won't look at it. And that for me remains one of the biggest gaps. And we're seeing really exciting businesses that we've supported get to a stage where they're having to raise more equity to build things that really should be funded with debt. And it creates a situation where certain shareholders aren't going to get the returns they were looking for and damages the prospects for investment into similar businesses in the future. So going back to advice that I might give to this government, if they're prepared to listen to me, I think supporting first-of-a-kind debt is something they can do quite easily through underwriting or co-investment programs, and that could be transformative for scaling technologies in particular.
HSBC Innovation Banking, our partner for this episode, provides commercial banking services, expertise, and insights to the technology, life science and healthcare, private equity, and venture capital industries. To find out why innovation needs different, go to www.hsbcinnovationbanking.com/en-gb. Now, you mentioned that your headquarters is at County Hall, and it's an interesting place to have ended up. It's an iconic building for many of people that know it in London. But you didn't just choose to stay there because of its proximity to Westminster. It was also a decision based on sustainable goals, wasn't it? And there was a refit that went on there as well. So talk me through what you've done to your offices there to make them fit for purpose, because so many buildings in London aren't really fit for purpose when it comes to sustainability.
Well, I'm still suffering from PTSD to some extent. It was a very stressful project that was many years in the making. But nonetheless, I'm really proud of our team and what they delivered there. As you say, it was a location that was driven by sustainability. Given the location, many people find it incredibly surprising that there were whole floors of County Hall that had sat unused for multiple decades. And so for us, the opportunity to bring an underutilized or indeed disused space back to life was the driving force behind our decision to go there. That and the incredible support of the Borough of Lambeth, and indeed the location played a part as well. But we're really pleased that what we built there is now the largest climate cluster in Europe.
And what were some of the things that you did there? Because I was reading about this, some very innovative building materials we used to make this, to insulate it, presumably, and make it fit for purpose. What talk us through some of those.
So we really did try to focus on using as many technology providers from our ecosystem as we could, obviously to make the property as sustainable as we could achieve, but also to provide a shop window for them to demonstrate their solutions to visiting politicians, corporates, investors and other partners. So in total, I think there are more than 30 of our wider ecosystem who contributed technical solutions to the building, covering everything from reusable modular wall systems, which allow us to redevelop and mold the space to people's needs and allow growing companies to increase the size of their office, for instance, working with an organization called U-Build. We focused on novel materials across the board, whether that's upcycled cork flooring in our event space or the tables in our kitchens being reused from school science labs. As you walk around the building, you can see examples of upcycling, reuse, and minimal solutions throughout the building. And if any of your listeners would like to come down for a tour, they're all very welcome.
And what do you think about the buildings in the city? I mean, these big skyscrapers that currently are underused because we're not going back to work in quite the same way. People aren't necessarily working 5 days a week anymore. Is there scope to retrofit all of those? Is that something that big cities should be thinking about doing?
Certainly making the best possible use of your existing building stock is critical. There is absolutely no point in investing in rezoning and large construction projects when you're well below capacity with a lot of your existing commercial real estate. So yes is the very short answer. Unfortunately, it's not always that simple. There are long-term leases in play and lots of competing stakeholders. But over time, we're finding more and more partners, whether that's local boroughs, whether that is large-scale developers, who are looking to make better use of their space, either on a temporary basis with meanwhile pop-up workspaces or hospitality hubs, or through completely changing the way the space is used. So that's a long-winded way of saying, yes, it's very important.
And you're not limited to London. You're not London-centric. You've got offices as well in Cambridge and Manchester. What was the thinking behind picking those? Is there a lot of stuff going on in Cambridge and Manchester specifically, or was there other reasons why those are your other two sites?
Cambridge, on a per capita basis, is one of the most active tech and indeed climate tech investment ecosystems in the world. So certainly a place that we wanted to be at the heart of, supporting those exciting new technical opportunities. It's also very close to my home. So for selfish commuting miles reasons, it works very well. But Manchester for us is a really important project where we are delivering a quite large co-working space of the kind that we have in London in County Hall, and trying to build that climate tech ecosystem in the Northwest. And from an investment perspective and from a supportiveness of the local authority, it's been a wonderful environment to be developing these ecosystems in.
Now, as somebody with more than 700 companies on your books, you must have a good idea of what works and what doesn't when you're setting up a company in this sort of area. So give me some tips and some definite don't do's from what you've learned so far and with the companies you've dealt with.
Very interesting question. So I think, first of all, you've got to be able to wind forward from the present day to see how your solution is going to be deployed in the market, to understand both that funding journey and that commercialization journey. And if you can't map that out, then you're going to have a very hard time convincing people to support you along the way. So having that crystal ball and being able to understand how your solution is going to get to market is critical. But for me, the single biggest differentiator between the solutions we support that work and those that don't is the entrepreneur or entrepreneurs. And personally, I like to undertake a bit of a hubris test. The entrepreneur as a protected class is almost always a confident beast and has no problems whatsoever selling a dream. But the very, very best entrepreneurs are those that actually are very self-aware and know what they're good at, what they're not good at, where they've got skills gaps to fill, and where they're going to need to work with external partners. So the people I get really excited about working with are those that know where they need help and are prepared to go and seek it.
And have you seen any lessons in what you should definitely not do?
I think being a domain expert really helps. So again, the vast majority of the businesses we see succeed have an entrepreneur that knows the industry they're operating in really very well. They might well be deploying a new technology, but they know the industry that it's going into. Those that typically struggle simply because they don't know what they don't know, those that are coming from a different sector altogether, or generalists that are trying to move into the climate space. And that's not to say that we don't need talent in this sector, we really do. But it is important to deeply understand your market and the industry partners you're going to be working with. And those that don't heed that advice will almost certainly run into traps they don't see.
Now, when it comes to technology and the climate crisis, there does tend to be, among some people, an assumption that tech will solve everything. It's not going to, is it? This is not just a tech problem, this is a people problem. How do you see, working with these companies that are offering these tech solutions, how do you see that sort of balance working out in future?
So I think what you've said is absolutely critical. There are lots of fantastic R&D facilities across this country, universities and the technical departments of established businesses producing really interesting technologies. But to be perfectly honest, that tech push approach all too often results in technologies that don't really have a place in the market. We try to look at things completely the other way around. Start from the market opportunity. The technology solutions are out there. There are lots of them. Some of them are more fit for purpose than others. But start from the market need and then identify the technical solutions to fit it. I think people are going to be a big part of this solution. But I genuinely don't believe we will see the levels of mass adoption that we need of solutions that will solve climate change if there is a green premium, if people are expected to sacrifice an economic solution or the quality of the service that they're receiving. I really do believe that we need to be bringing solutions to market that people really want and can buy into and get excited about without having to sacrifice.
And I guess I know the answer to this because you're working in this sector, but it's a problem that really divides people between the pessimists and the optimists. So where do you sit on that side of the fence when you're thinking about the future?
I'm certainly a climate optimist. As you say, to some extent, I think you have to be operating in this space. But I'm firmly of the opinion that fear and anger, while sometimes quite justified when you're engaging with these issues, are not great motivators in the long term. But economic opportunity really is.
And what is the future of the sustainable ventures? I mean, what do the next 5 years look like for you? Is it just more investment or what are your plans, long-term plans?
We want to build the largest climate tech ecosystem in the world by 2030. And so that is very much our focus. 5 years ago, we set a mission to support 1,000 companies by 2025. And we're well on target to deliver that. So we are looking bigger without question, and certainly looking not only outside of London to the rest of the UK, but also to Western Europe more broadly as well. We're also beginning to look at technical solutions that try to address issues in some of the most hard to abate sectors. So sectors like concrete production, as we mentioned before, but also others like aviation fuels, sectors that have been a little bit too hard for commercially minded businesses to address in the past. but the solutions are beginning to emerge. And that's really where we see a lot of the most exciting opportunities over the next 5 years.
And when you say Western Europe, are there specific countries you're looking at targeting, or how wide would you throw your net?
We, with our own development, will follow our own instructions and be demand-led. So we aren't going to go building workspaces and establishing ecosystems anywhere and everywhere. We will go where there is a budding innovation space in climate tech already. And much like not picking my favourite companies or my favourite children, I'm not going to go naming any cities at this point, but watch this space.
Well, thank you, Chris Morris, for a fascinating conversation. And of course, to everybody who's been listening to it. We'll be back with another episode next week. But in the meantime, you can keep up to date with all the latest UK tech developments at www.uktech.news. Don't forget to follow UKTN on LinkedIn and X, where you can get in touch with me at Jane Wakefield with your comments and suggestions about the show. Until next time, goodbye from me. HSBC Innovation Banking, our partner for this episode, provides commercial banking services, expertise, and insights to the technology, life science and healthcare, private equity, and venture capital industries. To find out why innovation needs different, go to www.hsbcinnovationbanking.com/en-gb.